new dawn, it's a new day, and welcome to the first birthday edition of Big Mouth, the talk show for the thinking pop culture addict. Yes, we have been running for exactly a year this weekend. I'm Andrew Harrison, and this week we will be poring over the new 10th series of Doctor Who, the last outing for Peter Capaldi and showrunner Stephen Moffat, and what looks like a one-off season for Pearl Mackie as new companion Bill Potts. 12 years since Russell T. Davis brought the show back, is it possible to reinvent it for the, what is it, fifth time? And how are we going to look back on Peter Capaldi's time in the TARDIS? To help us with all this, we've got a guest who really knows what she's talking about on this particular subject. Also, we'll be digging into the world of Dad House with the second solo album by Joe Goddard of Hot Chip and the Two Bears. Electric Lines put soul, house and disco in a blender for the, shall we say, senior raver. Will it get our hands in the air and will we indeed just not care? Also, we'll be taking a look at Sky's incendiary new drama, Guerrilla, featuring Frida Pinto and Idris Elba in the world of 1970s urban activists. Is director John Ridley's series a timely window into the world of the British Black Panthers? Or is it a self-flagellatory piece of pornography designed for white liberal pillocks, as the Spectator charmingly put it? And as usual, we'll be playing some of our guests' favourite tunes of the moment. So, let's meet them. I mentioned her earlier. Jenny Colgan is a best-selling and prolific author of popular women's fiction. We don't call it chick lit anymore. Not supposed to call it chick lit. Or are we? Can we call it chick lit?
No, don't be disgusting. How many women in your life do you call chicks, Andrew?
Not at all.
Right, excellent. I would like to join and be part of the non-chick brigade. Yeah, thank you.
They would throw your book at me if I called them chicks.
I just feel romantic comedy is a perfectly
there
appropriate.
We go. Nope.
Hello.
Jenny is a massive Doctor Who fan who has written tie-in novels and short stories featuring Matt Smith and David Tennant's Doctors, and also audio dramas with the actual David Tennant, Catherine Tate and Alex Kingston in them. She is blatantly Scottish, so probably massively biased towards Peter Capaldi and Stephen Moffat. Hello, Jenny. Welcome to Big Mouth. You actually wrote as well an actual sci-fi romance, didn't you, recently, called Resistance is Futile.
Resistance is Futile, and I have a new one coming out, which we wanted to call The Sex Lives of the Superheroes. Which is about, that's exactly what it's about. But superheroes, of course, is a trademark owned jointly by Marvel and Warner. You cannot use it. So now it's called something not very good now. It's called Spandex in the City is what it's called now. I do not love, but effectively, you know, asterisk. It's about a girl trying to date a superhero and how difficult and potentially cruddy that would be.
So you can use superhero in the natural novel.
No, you can't. Not at all. The word belongs to Marvel.
What about the two words together separated by
I think we got away with supers at one point, but I think it was very boring. Literally, somebody was interviewing me about the book and they said, what was the hardest bit about writing this novel? And I was like, copyright infringement.
God. So, well, up and Wahey, the forthcoming superhero novel of romance. Also with us, we have Big Mouth regular Joe Muggs, who writes about dance music, raving and records that sound like cutlery being dropped down a well for Mixmag, The Wire and The Guardian, and anybody else who will have him. Joe is our man on the grime and dubstep beats. As you know, this is essential to the Big Mouth mix. Welcome back to Big Mouth. How are you, Joe?
I'm not too bad, thank you very much.
What exactly is happening in the world of grime right now?
The world of grime is quite happily cruising along at the moment. We've got some bona fide superstars who are now sitting pretty with proper grime, as opposed to your vocoded pop house grime records of 5, 6, 7 years ago. And you've got a really interesting thing with the older generation bringing very gritty old guy war story kind of albums.
Dad grime.
It is very much dad grime. I mean, as I think we mentioned a couple of podcasts ago, there are actually people talking about fatherhood now seriously within their grime records. But, you know, you've got these guys like P Money, like Flo Dan, who are grizzled veterans, and there's real kind of imparting the wisdom, passing it down to the new kids, and there are actually kids doing grime again now as well.
Okay, well, you just heard him hopping in there as well. Also with us this week, keeping a firm hand on proceedings and ensuring no deviation, hesitation or repetition, it's our meticulous producer, the Larry Levan of podcast, Matt Hall. Hello, Matt. How are you?
Stripped naked to the waist and going on for 12 hours.
Absolutely, yes. It's a beautiful scene, isn't it? Have you been enjoying your week-long election-based national nervous breakdown then? Back to the 1970s, isn't it? A general election every 5 minutes.
It is like the 1970s at the moment, basically because of all the bank holidays. It's just like having a three-day week as well. So, yeah. You know, it's, yeah.
Well, we should turn the lights off in the studio for very similar tune.
I haven't put the bins out for 4 months either, so it's kind of stacking up around the back of our house just to get that kind of proper scent going.
Beautiful. Okay, let's make a start. Let's let's escape from the abject misery of planet Earth for as long as we possibly can. The 10th series of the revived Doctor Who started last weekend with Peter Capaldi's 12th Doctor squirreled away as a university lecturer, the TARDIS parked in his study, and new companion Bill Potts stumbling inside, pursued by a waterlogged space lesbian. This is the traditional Doctor Who that we always wanted, of course. The new back-to-basics approach, and especially Pearl Mackey as Bill, both seem to have gone down very well. What does our panel think? We'll get into it after this. So you know how you've always wondered if there's a Scar version of the Doctor Who theme? Well, there is. Here are the Simmertones. Admit it, your life was not complete without a Scar version of Ron Grainer's Doctor Who theme. That was the Simmertones. I wondered, do they do Steptoe and Son as well? So, Doctor Who is back. It's Capaldi and Stephen Moffat's last series, and it might be Pearl Mackey's last series as well. Doctor Who used to be a niche concern for people like Jenny and me. Now it is in the national spotlight, and more people care who is the showrunner than care who is Foreign Secretary. Jenny Colgan, what did you make of the opening episode of the new series?
Well, I think there was quite a low bar for everyone to be delighted, but I think everyone was pleased. You know, it was no 11th hour or Christmas invasion, but do you know what it did for me? It did the most important thing, which is to remember what Russell always used to say. Every episode of Doctor Who is some kid's first ever episode of Doctor Who. So, yeah, you know, stop throwing them into the middle of stuff nobody understands. And I like that. I knew Pearl was going to be very good, which I thought she was. And also she was a person, which I feel was useful in companion terms. Also, I tell you the thing I didn't...
As opposed to an object.
Seriously.
Or a plot device, actually. Yeah, yeah.
There wasn't much plot, which was fine. I didn't mind. It was about introducing everything to people that don't know what it is because it's been off the air for so long. But my kids, of course, they've never seen The Ring or anything like that, and they haven't seen, they don't show Waters of Mars again, of which this had a lot in common for a couple. One, because it's a funny length, and two, because the suicide was deemed a little dark at the time and still doesn't work very well. So they hadn't even seen that. They were terrified.
Yeah.
And I was kind of like, oh, I really kind of put the mystery to one side because it's not what's important about this episode. But they were proper can't get to sleep, lights on, and that was lovely. They haven't been like that for ages.
Yeah, proper fear.
You know, the Daleks aren't scary anymore. The last thing that really scared them were those scarecrows in Family of Blood, and that was a while back.
It was only 10 years ago, hasn't it? Maybe actually 10 years ago.
Yes, well, on repeat, I guess.
Yeah. Do you think, is it fair to say that Capaldi has found it hard to find his feet in the previous two seasons?
Oh my goodness. As soon as I heard that electric guitar, I was like, no. But actually, they seem to have sorted out. I think there was always a problem when casting older. And as a man, he's very, very notoriously sweet guy. Hmm. It was a decision made as an older guy coming in to make him grumpy and aggressive. And it's not a decision I would necessarily have taken. And I think this time round, they've managed to just pull it back and kind of really push it down. If you look at his first series where someone would die and you go, oh yeah, get over it. You know, it wasn't, my kids were just like, my little one, she was only four and she's like, where's the real doctor gone? She was upset. Whereas now they've really pulled him back. I loved having the grandchild picture on his desk, was lovely. That sense now. And also because he is now far too old to even make it look like there might be any romance there. And I thought that worked well for it too. So yeah, they've dialed him down. They've gentled him up and done. I have a horrible feeling we're going to see a series of what he should have been like all along.
Well, I think I like the idea of a swan song of being D-Mob happy, because there's so much old stuff coming up, isn't there? There's like original Cybermen from 1966 that only me and you can remember.
And the thing is, I am a big fan. I hate that. You know, why don't make B-side special rarity tracks?
I think that's the point. It's the point that, I totally accept your ability and need to kind of like invest in Doctor Who. Doctor Who's on Saturday night at kind of 7:30 because it's a family show. It's for kids.
I actually agree with you on that one.
And you know, and I can remember my first kind of like scary Doctor Who, Green Death, Big Maggots. But you
classic
know,
episode.
And I think everybody needs that. Oh, you know, and the last kind of couple of series, we haven't watched at home because my kids have just been going, time glitch, caught in you know, Matrix kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Doesn't like mean anything to a 9-year-old.
It really
doesn't. They want monsters.
Yeah, whereas a big water monster with black hair, we may have seen it before, they haven't, and they went out of their tiny
mouth. Joe Muggs, you're a bit more semi-detached on the Doctor Who fronts, aren't you? And you've got little kids. What was your take on this opening episode?
I'm a absolute fair weather Whovian.
Get out.
I know. I was kind of living.
I think that's good.
I was living in fear of getting a sonic screwdriver somewhere painful. That admission. But I had also blanked the last two series. I was lukewarm, to be honest, on Eccleston. Didn't like David Tennant very much. The only Doctor I've invested in.
I would say that's a fair weather Doctor.
I'd say that's quite negative.
The only Doctor of the reboot that I've invested in has been Matt Smith.
Right.
In the middle period before it got space opera, and then when it really got space opera and overly invested in who was whose forebear.
You are your own grandmother. Yes.
And you know, I like space operas, but that's not what I watch Doctor Who for. It was enough to draw me back in. I will be watching the next Doctor Who. It was comfort blanket Doctor Who.
Yes.
It was just very watchable. It's still too knowing. There's still too many, like, zip-zap bits of to and fro dialogue.
I thought they'd dial that right down.
They have compared to how bad it got.
It used to be all zingers all the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, and actually that undercuts the fear and the threat. If somebody can make some wisecrack while a spaceship is about to crash into a sun, then you kind of think they're not really frightened, are they?
No, absolutely. No, but you're comparing it to how really over the top it had got. And it's still there, and I wish it was less. I wish it was played even straighter. But the pacing was great. The acting was great. The Bill is great. Really good, actually.
It looks an awful lot like she's only going to get one season, which I think could either be a terrible, terrible shame and a terrible waste, or if the story is told to a good conclusion, could be brilliant. Just as Eccleston got one season and his story was told completely, and then off he went. Mm. Yes.
I mean, you know, she like Rose, she could end up being a recurring character down the line.
I really hope not, because Rose was kind of messed up by turning her into this kind of intergalactic woman with a gun.
Not in the same way necessarily, but you know, the precedent is there for an assistant to not have a run and then leave.
I think we're going to be looking at a very strong raft of changes from the next season.
Yeah,
I wouldn't expect anything you like or dislike to be hanging around apart from the box.
Right. Well, I mean, I'm up for that because that's what makes
out of the box. Thinking out of the
totally
box.
Out of the box. Yeah. Something that Matt mentioned just then, that you know, it should be the idea that things from 1968 should recur and things from 1974. You know, I absolutely agree because being ancient, I've now seen it go through several cycles of being obsessed with its own past, whereupon the viewer goes, what the hell's going on here? I mean, Jenny and I will have spotted Mavellans from 1979 in this one. And I'm like, yeah, hooray. And then I thought, well, hang on, that's clearly there to amuse the likes of us. Was it really Susan Danielle in her hot gossip outfit? Who knows?
Do you know what? I see, it bothers me that when I see stuff like that, because I'm like, yeah, all right, but you've got me. You've got me. You've got Andrew. You've got us. You know, we're not... Ignore us. We're just going to complain anyway. We can go and wear off on Gallifrey Base if we've got a problem. Forget about us. Think a lot about my 8-year-old, you know? Think about him. Think a lot about the mums of families who often choose the viewing on a Saturday night, who were very, very on board with the whole David Tennant situation and considered being on board with the Matt Smith situation. And then, you know, Amy had a baby and they forgot all about it and then were very much off. You know, think about them. Don't think about us.
Well, the ongoing...
The overnights were not spectacular.
No, they weren't. But then, you know, I think what this goes back to is like Russell Davis's formula was a brilliant one because by putting in the feeling and the love and romance, which gets all the grumpy science fiction fans really annoyed, you know, and they want to meet Davros's granddad or something like that. But actually, that was what ensured it could go on at tea time on a Saturday and not 9 o'clock on a Tuesday on BBC Two, where only you and I would watch it, you know. And I think when people
want to fight for their place in the culture.
Yeah.
And I think they will.
Anyway, let's move on. Every week we ask our guests to bring in their favourite tune of the moment, old or new, whatever they like, an editor's recommendation. Joe Muggs, what have you brought for us?
I've got a track from Hi-Fi Sean, formerly of the Soup Dragons. Sean Dixon, his name is, who we'll all remember as being thoroughly baggy, the Scots baggy.
Yes.
With their semi-Rolling Stones cover of I'm Free, and they really made quite a success of the transition from jangle jangle indie mm-hmm. to ravers. The story is brilliant. I mean, well, it wasn't entirely brilliant from his point of view.
It's a bit of a heartbreaker, isn't it?
It's an absolute heartbreaker. I mean, so Sean is now 50. He had quite a lot of success with the Soup Dragons. He moved to New York. He was going to all the gay clubs. He didn't suspect that he was gay, or he had he was married. He was married with a child, and then something snapped. He came out to himself and left his family, and essentially had a breakdown and was unable to make music for 15-odd years. And all that kept him going was DJing. And he ended up moving to London as a newly minted homosexualist, joining the gay scene and becoming an after-hours DJ, playing at 8 a.m, which is this kind of otherworldly space, you know, at the clubs in Vauxhall on Monday mornings. And then finally, like, drawing himself back together, making friends, reconnecting with the old friends that he'd kind of cut off from because he felt so guilty. And made this really beautiful kind of, as we might say of the Joe Goddard album, Dad House record, really. It's slow motion disco and house.
Well, the album's called Foot, as in featured, featuring FT Dot. And this is from, there's a remixed edition of it coming up for Record Store Day. This track is Like Josephine Baker, featuring David McCalmont. This is the Omnicord Excursion version. This is Hi-Fi Sean. Like Josephine Baker, featuring David McCalmont by Hi-Fi Sean, as chosen by our guest Joe Muggs. So let's stay with the dancing music, specifically the Dad House sounds of Joe Goddard. He's one of Hot Chip, he's half of house duo The Two Bears, and his solo album Electric Lines is out this week. What makes a great grown-up dance record? We'll discuss it all after this. The lead single from Electric Lines, this is Home. Home by Joe Goddard of Hot Chip from his album Electric Lines. Joe Muggs, this is your specialist subject. Your starter for 10. Is it any good?
It's mostly excellent, I would say. He's really tried to make a pop record as well as a very groovy dance record. And, you know, I think that maybe it tips over into saccharin on one or two tracks, but only one or two tracks. And the rest of it is knockout.
It's enormously belyric, isn't it? Very kind of relaxed and sunny, and particularly that track Home, the opening single, with its like falls into Philly soul halfway through.
Yeah, absolutely. And Music Is the Answer is just complete disco bliss, and you can definitely see the beautiful people shimmying on a terrace in the sunshine somewhere to it.
Yeah. Jenny, are you a bit of a raver on the quiet? Have you had a dance music period in your life?
I am not. No. In fact, I tell you, this makes me feel so ancient, because when you were like, dad, oh, it's really dad hip-hop, it's dad dance music. Whereas actually, I loved it, and it felt like the young person's music to me. That's how old I am. It made me want to be 19 and going on some terrible club holiday, which in reality, one, I never did, and two, I would have hated if I had ever done it.
And three, this is the last kind of music you'd actually hear on one of those holidays.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think one of those holidays you'd probably, well, Joe knows this better than any of us, but it'd be a bit more up and in your face, wouldn't it?
Oh,
pumping
gosh,
in your
I
face.
It's got hand clapping on it, it's got doinks on it. I really thoroughly enjoy it.
Oh, no, you will actually find it's all about the Dalmatian scene now. It's
the Dalmatian scene?
It's all about the Adriatic coast. It's, you know, there's a whole lot of festivals now along the coast of Croatia where the young people will go and listen to an awful lot of laid-back disco.
It's just so sunny. It's just, in fact, I did think annoying people were going to be blasting it really loudly out of their cars.
So this is like downbeat and it's being played down there. Is it 101 BPM Dalmatians? Will that work? I don't know.
Please.
What do you think?
Put your crowbar down and step away from the microphone.
The golden shoehorn of world.
I only have one talent, Matt, and you know that it's these things. I mean, I really like this. I think you're right. It is like blast it out of your car kind of stuff. You mentioned, you know, we were talking about dad house. I think there is something, you know, the older you get, the less you want the thing to be massively abrasive, the more you want something you can just drift away to. And it's certainly, you know,
political antidote to music.
yeah. I mean, there's nothing, you know, the most important thing in the world is escapism and indeed escapology. Joe, who makes the best dad house records then? What should we be looking for?
Oh, crumbs. I mean, the Norwegians are all over it.
Right.
I mean, Todd Terrier, Prince Thomas, Lindstrom, these guys have been rolling out these beautiful slow motion synth disco stroke house stroke, a bit 80s pop, a bit freestyle type records for years and years and years. And they probably set the scene for people to be happy to have stuff that's less than 120 BPM. And I really emphasise that this is not actually old people music.
Mm.
I mean, Joe Goddard is a big jolly bear-like dad, you know.
Can I put a bit of dissent in? I didn't enjoy this at all. I thought it was really kind of academic and totally unlike the stuff that he does with Two Bears, which is much kind of more joyous and kind of a sense of losing yourself with the music. I felt this was a real kind of like putting stuff together by algorithms. It was very kind of very European take on house music, and I found it didn't have any soul, in my opinion.
Ooh, I'm surprised you say that, because there's a lot of actual, shall we say, tropes. There's actual soul tropes in there.
Yeah,
big chunky samples, and I think some really good vocals from across the board. You got Alexis Taylor doing his hot chip pathos thing, but he seems to have discovered a bunch of new people as well.
As before, I mean, I like Alexis Taylor, but I think he sounds like that guy out of the Corgis and does that kind of English kind of phoning it in thing, which is good, but he does it very well, and that's his kind of one
but
trick.
Do you want a belter? Do you want to?
I just want
to
kind of hands in the air, kind of gospel diva, you know, losing yourself. And none of when listening to house music, the thing is, what would this sound like at kind of 2 o'clock in the morning after like a real kind of massive banger? And I think it'd be a real letdown.
This is what Joe Goddard has always done, though. I mean, you know, his big club track as a solo producer was Gabrielle, and it's a heartbreaker, and it was also a 2 a.m. anthem.
Yeah.
You know, it was huge across a whole range of clubs.
Also, there are 23 other hours in the day, you know, and you might want to listen to something at 10 o'clock in the morning, you know. And
I mean,
being up at 2 o'clock in the morning is really hard when you're old. Really, really hard.
And some people were scared of nightclubs.
Some people are scared of
nightclubs. Funnily enough, I have to puff my own piece in Mixmag. I have a piece in Mixmag this month, which is singing it's in the defence of coffee table music. It's in defence of 3 p.m. music.
Yes. 3 p.m. eternal.
You talked about escapism, but it's not even escapism. It's where we step out of all of the pressures of job and life and who we're supposed to be and actually connect with our friends, music that you have conversations over, a cup of tea or a pint or a glass of wine or whatever your poison is. It's music of intimacy, the kind of music that you have outside of the clubs and the places that music is pumped at you, and it's actually as important a part of our lives. And it's not just escaping from things, it's escaping into something that's powerful and constructive.
I also think you're more likely to take lyrics like music is the answer to your problems and you know, things that sound like a platitude. You're more likely to take that from somebody in their late 40s or 50s. You feel like it's been around the block.
I'll take it from anyone. I'll take any answer.
Yeah, whatever you got. Yeah. Okay, so let's have a bit of a commercial break. Well, we don't do enough voting these days, do we? Referendums, general elections, TV, talent contests. If you don't get to go vote at least once a day for something, you start to worry that we're sliding into some sort of dictatorship. Well, luckily, you've got one last chance to vote in the British Podcast Awards. And of course, it would be fantastic if you could vote for Big Mouth in the Listener's Choice category. Voting is very simple. Just go to britishpodcastawards.com and click the Listener's Choice Award at the top of the page. Vote for Big Mouth and you can help us wipe the smile off S-Town's face. In fact, if you're listening to us on your desktop, why not do it right now while we play some more music? Because it's time for another editor's recommendation from one of our guests, Jenny Colgan. What have you got for us?
Oh, this is, it's not Mum House, but it is the kind of thing, Mum's Lake, which is, we lived in France for a long time, and this was a big, big pop hit. And French music, pop music, of course, is traditionally dreadful. And then Christine the Queen's kind of turned up and everyone had to slightly change their mind, which was annoying for me. But this is, well, it's an old Michel Sardou song, but the version we're going to hear is by their version of, it's called Starac, and it's their version of The X Factor. So if you can imagine an even worse version of The X Factor, if you can imagine it. And this is Luan. She didn't win. I think she was like third. She was like the One Directioner. And right. She was cast in this highly popular and actually very charming film called La Famille Bélier, which is about a deaf couple who have a hearing child. And not only can the child hear, but she can sing. And it's about to become a dreadful American remake. Can you imagine how bad it's going to be? Anyway, Luan played the title character and she sings this beautiful, it's a beautiful song anyway, and I think she sings it beautifully, and it's Je vole.
Mes chers parents, je pars. Je vous aime et je pars. Vous n'aurez plus d'enfants ce soir. La 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 la. La 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 la. Je vole. Je vole.
That was Je vole by Luan, as chosen by our guest, top-selling novelist Jenny Colgan, with French tastes. OK, let's move over to TV and Sky Atlantic's new big-ticket drama, Guerrilla. Set in London in 1971, it's a fictionalised look at black activists and political radicals who are inspired by the American Black Panthers to take up their own struggle in the capital. We see a politically active couple played by Frida Pinto and Babu Cisse coming up against the racism and repressive policing of the day. Directed by John Ridley, the Oscar-winning writer of 12 Years a Slave, the miniseries strives for accuracy and verisimilitude. But it was attacked before its release by campaigners who said that by casting an Indian actress in a starring role, the show was erasing black women from this period in history. So, is Guerrilla worth watching, and are those criticisms valid? We'll talk about those things after this. From the closing credits to episode one, from the 1971 album We Had to Let You Have It, this is How Long by Noir. How Long by Noir from Sky Atlantic's Guerrilla. Now, this is not another Life on Mars, Weren't the 70s Great Show by a long chalk. The setup brings together the Blair Peach case, another major brutality incident from 1970s policing. Marcus and Jazz, the Frida Pinto and Babu Cisse characters, are campaigning for black prisoners. We see them amongst the radical multiracial lefties of London's golden era. And two cops, played by Rory Kinnear and Danny Mays, are targeting a particular campaigner. Now, Jenny Colgan, this goes in very powerfully, doesn't it? It does not stint on the violence at all. Yeah. Did you enjoy it?
Do you know, at first, there's a scene quite early on where there's a kind of community meeting where they all tell you that they're in 1971 and that things are bad. And I thought, oh, this is going to be a bit like this. You know, it's like, well, should we do peaceful protests? And the other one says, no, and this is why. And they have conversations that were unlikely. Yeah. And I couldn't get past... Frieden's got very un-70s hair because I remember the 70s.
Yeah.
And he either looked like Crystal Tips or you look like a chip pan had just been upended over you. So I was like, there's no serum, you know. And as soon as I stopped noticing the serum, the hair serum, then I found myself getting more and more drawn in as it went on. And by the time they got to the IRA cameo, of course Rory Kinnear turns up, he's brilliant. Do you know, because Tim Pigott Smith died this week, didn't he? And I was just like, here's our new Tim Pigott Smith, you know, to haunt your dreams of evil bureaucracy for the rest of your life. And I did get into it, and by the time they were doing the ridiculous prison breakout and things like that, I was and Frida's taking the bus with something up. Anyway.
Yeah. Smuggling by unorthodox methods. Yes.
So actually I did. I was quite hooked by the end. My only concern about it, and also them, I always love when they try and do riot scenes and there's obviously 9 people there. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. I thought the riot scene was actually pretty well mounted. It looks like it was a good old turnout. Good old turnout.
There.
Yeah, yeah.
I do.
You had to make your own entertainment.
You did, yeah.
Yes. So, yes, party scenes and riot scenes. Always the tricky ones. So I was quite into it by the end. My only concern is if this had been 5 or 6 years ago and it was going out on BBC One at 10 o'clock on a Tuesday night, I think the whole country would have been completely gripped.
Well, it's been launched as an instant binge box set on Sky. You can watch it all in one go. I dug a little bit further into it. I think it's fantastically well made, but I do think, you know, there's definitely a question about conservatism on mainstream, you know, mainstream broadcast television, network telly, shall we call it, in that the edgy and the exciting stuff, because Sky is so keen to prove its point,
yes,
that it's creatively free,
yeah, that's where it's going.
Then this stuff doesn't get onto BBC One. We had a podcast a while ago talking about the remake of Roots, which went out on National Geographic or something.
It went out on BBC Four.
Yeah,
because I sat my son down to watch it, and after about half an hour, I put it off. And was like, no, you're going to read it, then you can watch it.
Yeah,
you know,
because
they have to. They're all gorgeous, and you have to skate through it at 100 miles.
But the BBC did do something quite similar. Was it last year that Undercover with Adrian Lester, which was tackling the same kind of topics about a police unit and black radicals in the kind of eight, that was the 80s.
I have a question: how much of it is true?
Well, that's a very interesting thing, isn't it?
I was wondering that because I've watched the second episodes. There's some things that happen in that as well. And you're thinking,
well, there's a conflation of a lot of stuff. I mean, there's the fact that Farouk Dondi and Darkus Howe are consultants on this.
Right.
Makes me, and there's actually a little tiny cameo for Darkus Howe. Blink and you'll miss him. Yeah.
The Stan Lee of
Black Power. Yeah. And it makes me think that, well, there's got to be, you know, it's got to be broadly true here. I think it clearly conflates a lot of events. You know, I mentioned Blair Peach earlier on, the Black Panthers. There are things here that didn't actually happen. But to me, it is a work of fiction. And what it's about is letting people like us, white people, understand what it's like to live in a world where you're perpetually looking over your shoulder and you can't trust authority at all and you know it's out to get you. Now, there are strong elements of truth in that. You know, no doubt there are things that have been fictionalised and massaged. But, you know, these are important things that ought to be on the television, aren't they? Joe, what did you think of it?
I actually ended up loving it. I mean, and I think I will watch the whole series. I went through almost exactly the same set of processes as Jenny. I mean, the 70s was a lot grottier than that. You know, I was like, where is the dirt? Where are all the cigarettes? Where is the greasy hair? Precisely that.
Yeah.
I went through a flicker of not all white people. And then it was like...
But as the show develops, you start to see that. You start to see that it's much more complicated than the really great Black Panthers and the really bad
white
cops. Well,
exactly. I mean, yeah. I'd read people talking on Twitter that, oh, it only makes... So, you know, the only good white people are the Irish revolutionaries. It was like, no, actually, the IRA guy comes over as an absolute arse.
Yeah, and actually, Danny Mays' copper.
I love Danny Mays.
He's great. Doctor Who graduate Danny Mays.
On all sides,
they're complicated characters. Yeah. And by halfway through, I was like, I don't know where this is going. Yeah. I don't know where each of these characters is going. There are processes of development. I am watching this as a thriller. The politics is there and it's an undercurrent and it's broadly true, because I remember being at school in the 70s and how very, very racist everything was.
Yeah.
And it is overly glossy, and Frida Pinto, she's almost impossibly gorgeous.
Yeah.
And that's kind of, you know, like there is this kind of field around her that you have to discount a little bit. But...
Well, while we're talking about her, Zoe Ashton is in it as well. She's got hair too. That's admirable hair.
She's terrific. It is wonderful. I often feel, I feel awful for actors in terms of the fact that they don't get residuals anymore and they can't rely. On the other hand, it means you can just cast anybody in anything and get all these wonderful people.
And the thing has been presented as starring Idris Elba, and actually he's quite a secondary character, isn't he? He's there as a kind of sounding board.
He's a exec producer, I think, and he wasn't meant to be in it. And then they were like, mate, if you're here, would you mind being in it? And he's like, and then he bent down really far so he could see the camera. And
were people that tall in the 70s? I thought we all had bad diet in the 70s. My memory is everybody was really not as tall as Idris Elba.
Everyone was ugly in the 70s.
Yeah,
but is that makeup that makes him look? Is he kind of, because he looks quite old in this, and they've kind of really done.
He's
a good,
knackered from all those.
Well, I'm just wondering.
I just want to those the criticisms I mentioned earlier. On the one hand, it was the show was attacked by black campaigners by saying that it was erasing blackness in the 70s by having an Asian woman in the starring role, and then, like I say, The Spectator called it self-flagellatory pornography designed for white liberal pillocks. Does everything have to be tested to destruction before it goes on television now?
Oh, seriously, I can't. I'm not even going to answer
it
case I accidentally say the wrong one and it was the wrong thing.
But the idea that like everything has to be tested for what it means rather than what it is, because you know, if Farouk Dondi and Darkus Howe are okay with this show, then I think I'm probably okay with it as well. It doesn't need to be passed for you know, ticking all the boxes about what suits the political climate of now. There clearly were Asian women involved in the black rights struggle of the 1970s. The entire Gronwick dispute was run by Asian women.
I'm no historian, but it's drama. It's a drama. I mean, I guess what maybe it means is we just need more honest dramas from different perspectives about the issues involved, and then they balance each other out. Because if it's always on one thing to be entirely representative of everything, then it gets everything gets removed from the process of actually creating a drama.
Yeah, I just want to go back to Rory Kinnear for 1 minute. He, as you pointed out, he's fantastic in it as the horrendous policeman who has to be South African because it's okay to not like South Africa.
I think he's Zimbabwean.
Is he? Right. He was in the frame for Doctor Who at one point, wasn't he?
Everyone's been in the frame for Doctor Who. I think this is going to sound bad, but there's two things you need to be a good Doctor Who. One is you need long fingers, and two, you need a really good hair.
Okay. Oh, baldest. Oh, that's nice.
Sorry.
Thank you, Jenny.
I'm stating the facts as they are. Everyone born in Gallifrey has tremendous hair.
Rory Kinnear will always be the poetry quoting Frankenstein's monster for Penny Dreadful for me. It gets very confusing to see him not with stitches around his head.
Do you know, he's just someone, whenever he walks into a shot, you just perk up, don't you? You're like, Rory's here. It's gonna be, whatever it is he's going to do, he'll be horrible at it. It'll be great.
Gorilla is available now on Sky Atlantic, and you can watch the lot in one go if you press the download button. How does it work? I don't even know how it works anymore. Okay, well, we're coming up to the end of the show, and this means closing time chatter, the part of the show where our guests tell us the story, or the idea, or the feature, or the internet argument that's been getting their goat this week. Now, Jenny Colgan, I believe you've been fascinated by Melania Trump's photography.
Yeah, it was one of these things that, you know, if something gets retweeted about four times, then that's enough and it'll pop up. Yeah. I'll go and have a look at it. And it was on Medium, and it was by a filmmaker called Kate Imbach. And it's an essay called Fairy Tale Prisoner by Choice, The Photographic Eye of Melania Trump. And what she's done is gone through, because she's such a mystery, has gone through all the Instagram and all the tweets that she posted before this all happened to her, and judged it from the eye of a critical artist. And what she finds is that Melania is never in the pictures. It's always the same view. Everything is behind glass. Everything is high up in this fairy tale tower. It's this extraordinary construct of a life with utterly no life in it at all. The only person that has any life is her son, who gets to run and do things, and she's just trapped all the time. And it's really... Obviously, there is a kind of narrative that is interesting, that is what her life is like, but I can't see any other way. You know, does she have friends? Does she have fun? It doesn't seem... And literally from her own presentation of herself to the world, even before Donald was doing anything other than just walking around being a, you know, arsehole. There's nothing. She's locked up there. And it's just, it's really, really worth reading. And it finishes and she just says, well, you have to... You know, you can't look at this woman in any sense to excuse things or to apologise, because she's living inside a dark fairy tale, it says. And in fairy tales, the women trapped in towers never save anyone but themselves.
So we are looking at the building up of the American Princess Diana, the Rapunzel, Trumpunzel horror story.
Oh, we'll never know.
She's Princess Di as written by Bret Easton Ellis.
Oh, God.
Do you think there's not much there?
Let's take away the Princess Di bit. I mean, I look at Jared Kushner and I just see Bret Easton Ellis character.
Oh, now him. Yeah. But he's interesting. Psychologically, he's interesting. Melania is something else altogether.
But you know, the Bret Easton Ellis books are full of these just empty ciphers.
Fragile glass.
And
yes.
May live, may die, whatever. You know, it's
she is. She's
terrifying.
As thin as to be two-dimensional. She is quite fascinating.
What's it called again? So people can get Googling.
It's on Medium. .com, and it's called scroll Fairy Tale Prisoner by Choice, The Photographic Eye of Melania Trump, and it's really worth a read, I would say.
Fantastic. Now, Joe, Mika Vainio, the electronic musician.
Mika Vainio, yes. A genuine sad loss. A lot of my friends who work in the electronic music world and run festivals and so on considered him a friend. He's a towering figure. And yet, a lot of people don't know him. I mean, a lot of the people who know him don't know him.
Yeah.
He's a genuine enigma. I mean, the Finns do reserve in a way that we can barely dream of. And I know people who've worked with him for years and only heard him speak a dozen words. He was part of a duo, Panasonic, which inevitably, due to copyright, became Pansonic. He's recorded under his own name as Zero, or O, an O
that,
with a
that
slash
O through, with a slash through that they have in record. Scandinavia, yes.
Exactly that. Very, very prolific, very, very noisy on some occasions, but also very sparse. He's worked with the big guns of the experimental world, Remix Bjork. He did, I think Pansonic did an album with Alan Vega.
Well, we're going to play a little bit as we play out the show, but let's finish up Closing Town Chatter first. Matt, what have you got?
Just the brilliant story about a guy called Tim Burrows, who's a writer for various websites and stuff, was contacted this week on Twitter, or I think on Facebook actually, by a bloke who'd found his wallet at the Reading Festival in 2003. They'd handed it in, but before they'd handed it in, they'd taken a tenner out and spent it on cider.
On White Lightning.
On White Lightning. So he got his wallet back, but this guy contacted him to say, we're really sorry, we feel really bad about this, and would you like to know that in your honour, because of we spent this tenner that we took out of the wallet in 2003 on cider, we've had an annual drinking challenge in your name called the Timothy Burrows Drinking Challenge, without knowing who he was. And basically, two or three times a year, these guys get together and have a drinking challenge where they, teams of three, 4 litres of cider each, and they've got to drink it as quickly as they possibly can. And the guy said to him, the last time we had it, which was at Christmas, one of the team captains ended up wrapped in a rug for the rest of the night. So, good work.
And the moral of this story is what? Don't go to Reading.
Don't drink White Lightning.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's many, many,
many morals.
Many teachable moments there. Well, mine, we're going to stay on festivals, actually. I just want to give a shout out to the unfortunate phone thief at Coachella who stole only iPhones. And, of course, it's Coachella, so everybody has iCloud and Find My Phone turned on. And it's in the desert, so tracking down 100 iPhones, all moving suspiciously slowly in the one place, in the one direction, was surprisingly easy. Why are there 100 iPhones all moving across the map in the Indio Polo fields? I'm picturing an insufferable hipster version of Aliens. They're right here, man, right by the culturally inappropriate Native American headdresses. Game over, man. They're under the field.
Isn't that a thing? See, like, somebody hands a wallet in and feels really guilty about it and eventually gets in touch, and it's a heartwarming story.
Yes.
And somebody else nicks loads and gets lynched, presumably.
Yeah, well, you know, Coachella, pick a winner. You know, it's like the ground zero of...
So the moral of all the stories is people are idiots.
Yeah, that's... And there we have it. Well, that's a great note to end the show on. Thanks to our guests, Jenny Colgan, romantic novelist and Doctor Who super fan. Thank you for coming. What have you got? What's coming up next?
I'm going to a Kate Bush immersive Hounds of Love experience. I have no idea what's going to happen. We've been given a secret address and we've been told to dress in red or white and to set aside 5 hours.
5 hours? Fantastic.
Could be anything.
Right. And is this in famous London or is this elsewhere?
Well, it is. We found out this morning that it is in London.
That
which
helps.
Is something of a relief. And I'm just, you know, hoping to dance like an idiot and cry and do what people normally do when Kate Bush comes on, they're my age.
Next time you come on, you can do a reinterpretation of the dance routines
in
the studio.
Always.
Fantastic. Thanks too to Joe Muggs of Mixmag, The Guardian, Fact, Wired and all sorts of other interesting magazines. What are you doing next?
I'm blogging. I'm actually doing my own site, joemuggs.tumblr.com. Mm-hmm. And it's been quite nice to just do stuff under my own steam. And also I'm involved with a festival. I'm helping out with a festival called No Bounds in Sheffield, which is on my birthday at the beginning of June, which I'm really excited about. Unfortunately, it's the day after the general election, so it's going to be ruined, but
people are going to need cheering up.
On the other hand, I'll be there doing an exciting Q&A with Siberian techno goddess Lena Kravitz, so that will cheer up my day.
Swings and roundabouts. Exactly.
Yes, mom house. Okay, well, remember, you can hear this episode again, should you wish, and in fact all of our archive shows at audioboom.com/channel Big Mouth. Or you can go to the podcast section of the iTunes Music Store and search for Big Mouth there. If you subscribe, you will get the podcast direct to your device, be it an iPhone or whatever else, automatically, and you'll get the podcast early, around about Saturday lunchtime. And this means you'll have a whole day to pass off our guests' trenches opinions as your own. God knows I do. Thanks for listening, and to see you off, here is a track by the late electronic producer Mika Vainio. This is Aleva. We'll see you soon.